is coming to class this morning. I just love seeing everybody popping up on the screen. It is just so much fun. And I want to invite you all to take a look at each other as a way to just see one another. You may know, some of you will know each other because you've been coming to Wednesday Sangha for a long time, but just take a look. And if you're willing to turn your video on so we can say hello and see you, that's wonderful. If it doesn't work for you, that's fine also. So welcome everybody. The other thing that is really fun to do that I would like to invite you to do is to type into the chat where you're calling in from. I'm in Arcata, California. I'm not going to type in the chat. I'm about 300 miles north of San Francisco. So if you would be willing to do that, Uli's here from London. Welcome. Larkspur, Nancy, Pine Mountain Lake, Oakland, Indiana, San Rafael, springy Sonoma. It is springy, isn't it? Susan's here from Duluth. Oh, I'm glad to see you, John. Thank you for coming. Margo's here from San Diego. Did you ever see this is sort of a throwback? If anybody watched Romper Room as a kid, I don't remember the name of, like Miss Barbara or whoever she was, but she would say, "And here's Tommy from Chicago, and here's John from Indiana." This is not Romper Room, I promise, but maybe it's our form of Romper Room. Oh. So thank you all for coming. I really appreciate that you're here. Typically, what we do, the structure of our time together, is that we'll start with a short arriving meditation, and then I'll offer some thoughts, and then we'll have our longer meditation beginning about 9:30. But today, I would like to do things a little bit differently. We're going to start with a little bit of a longer meditation. And then I'll offer some thoughts. We'll take a break a little later than usual, a little bit after 11. We'll come back and meditate again. I'll offer some more thoughts, and we'll have time woven in all of that to talk with each other. So just a little bit of a heads up that it's a slightly different structure. Okay, so one of my I often say this, one of my favorite teachings, and I think about what are the teachings that have really influenced me or keep coming back to me that are compass questions or guides or things that just keep me on track in my practice. There are many. The one that I've been thinking about, one of them that I've been thinking about a lot this week is this story that about a student who goes to his teacher, who was Suzuki Roshi, and he says to Suzuki Roshi, "Roshi, after all these years of practice, your life and my life in practice, can you please just tell me what is the most important thing?" And the story goes that Suzuki Roshi said, "To find out what is the most important thing. That is the most important thing." And what I love about that is it gives a lot of creativity and flexibility to our practice, that what is the most important thing for me right in this moment might be different for you. And that it brings in our humanity, our differences, what's happening in our lives. So to just drop that question in for us today about allowing to bubble up. What is the most important thing? And we'll explore this in a few different capacities. So for now, we're going to settle into a meditation. So please find a posture in which you are comfortable, in which you can stay settled for the next 15, 20 minutes or so. And let's just begin by taking in your surroundings. When we take in our surroundings, maybe from a different view, like looking around the room, what you might notice that's different, what is the quality of light? It is a process of becoming present with what is right here, right now. Coming in contact with visual perception. And then when you're ready, letting the eyes close or just having a soft gaze downwards. And you still may notice some visual perception, light and dark, shadows, motion behind the eyelids, just noticing. And then becoming aware of sound, hearing and knowing your hearing, not listening to or for anything in particular, just becoming aware of sound. Nearby, far away, just notice. Maybe there's a smell or a taste you notice. Coming into each sense as a way to notice what is here right now. And then noticing the sensation of touch, the places the body is connected to furniture or the floor, whatever you're touching. How the body touches itself, the arms, the hands, the eyelids, the lips and tongue. Noticing these touch points. And then becoming aware of the state of mind and heart. They belong as well. What is here right now? And then lastly, aware of the breath coming and going. Sensing the inhale and the exhale, the motion the body makes in response to breathing, the expansion and contraction, the rise and fall, the full experience of breathing. Now turning the awareness to wherever is easiest for you to settle the attention, be it one of the senses, the body, the breathing. Settling there, and when the mind drifts, as it naturally will, and you notice it, come back gently, persistently, and kindly, and begin again. And we'll sit quietly. As the mind begins to settle, go with it. See if you can just follow that settling, perhaps experiencing the inhale as an arriving, and each exhale, continual settling in which the mind and the heart come together and rest. Just sensing into any amount of settling. Once again, noticing any amount of settling, resting inside the settling. And now, within this quiet, quieter mind, maybe a little bit of the heart showing up and the settledness of the body, to whatever degree you sense that openness, to adding in some curiosity and taking in this reflection question. Right now, what is the most important thing for you? Just dropping that question in and then making space to allow whatever bubbles up to bubble up. This is not with the intention for analysis. This is just to see what naturally arises. It might be more than one thing, but asking, dropping that question, right now, what is the most important thing? And maybe you notice some resonance in the body as that thing comes up, that thought, that awareness. See if you sense any reverberation or correlating sensation in the body with whatever it is that's come up. Good morning again, everybody. Welcome back. Okay, so I want to move into a very fundamental practice. And for those of you who have been in other classes with me this week, we're going to do it again. And you will recognize this shortly. So probably like you, the amount of violence that we have seen recently is profoundly disturbing. And to have two mass shootings in a week in this country is startling, at least, right? It's startling, it's frightening. It's unfortunately becoming part of what happens in our country. And I don't really know how to square that. I just saw a statistic that I can't even repeat to you about the numbers of guns that are actually in this country related to the numbers of people and then compared to other countries. And it's an astronomical number. So from the perspective of the Dharma, from our practice, what is the response to heartache, to grief, to loss, to this violence? How do we turn towards this, the truth of racism, xenophobia, misogyny, homophobia, any rejection of other? And so this is the question, what is the most important thing? How do we integrate this? How do we relate to it? And because the definition of the Dharma, one of the translations of the Dharma, is the truth, or the way things are, the nature of things. And so for me, I find it very important to get to the nitty-gritty around turning towards what is true in our culture and around just my own experience of what's around me, which includes not just my home and my community, but the greater community. And it has been important for me in my own practice to rely on the teachings of the Buddha. And as you know, the teachings are full of lists, and lists of threes and fours and fives and sevens and tens and, you know, whatever it is. But the lists are very helpful because they are guides. They are guides into our practice. They help me stay organized in some way. They become organizing principles. So two lists that are helpful to me. One is called the three pillars of practice, which includes, this is in the Pali, dana, sila, and bhavana. Dana is generosity. Sila, our ethical conduct, morality. And the bhavana means cultivation of mind. So it's generosity, morality, and the continual commitment to cultivating the clear mind through our meditation. And the other list that is important is sila, samadhi, panya. Again, ethical conduct. Samadhi means non-distracted awareness, concentration, cultivating this steadiness of mind. And panya, wisdom, the outgrowth of all of these practices. The Buddha said, avoid what is unskillful, do what is good, and purify the mind. This is the teaching of the Buddhas. Avoid what is unskillful, do what is good, and purify the mind. This is the teaching of the Buddhas, which is another way of saying dana, sila, and bhavana, or sila, samadhi, panya. All of those things happen as we commit to a path of practice, which means how we are in our lives. So our lives are an expression of our values, and our practice supports cultivation of these values of generosity, of morality, a commitment to understanding our minds, our habits of mind, so we can cultivate this clarity and insight and wisdom. So my typical pattern, I find that when I am frightened, when things happen like have happened in the last week, my natural place I go to in my practice is to recommit to my ethical life, to sila, to the practice of the precepts, which are the universal guides to non-harming. And I think of why I'm doing what I'm doing. Like, what is it that I am? My intention for my practice, for my life, is to learn how to more and more live a life that does not intentionally cause harm to myself or anybody else. And, you know, of course I blow it, of course. But what I want to do is understand how the forces of greed and ill will and delusion function in me. And when I can see those places where I reject myself or somebody else, where I hold a grudge or I have the ignoble, you know, snarky thought, I don't have to say it, I can feel it, but I can just notice it. What happens is if I come back to my intention to cultivate goodness through my ethical life, I often come back to the precepts, which I want to talk a little bit about. Sila, our ethical conduct and morality. Sila is, in addition to being translated as morality, ethics, it's also defined as harmony. And this is a very lovely way to think about our ethical lives as being in harmony with our values with the harmony of the greater good. Bhikkhu Bodhi, who is, many of you know, an American-born Theravada monk and a brilliant scholar and teacher of many, what he says about this is real peace is not simply the absence of conflict, but a state of harmony. Harmony between people, harmony between humanity and nature, and harmony within ourselves. Without harmony, the seeds of conflict and violence will always be ready to sprout. And we can see the little sprouts that come up. You know, the more we practice, we can see, oh yeah, there's that, there's that. And so we recommit over and over again. The Buddha's very important teaching that says, by protecting myself, I protect others. By protecting others, I protect myself, is profound. First time I heard that, it actually stopped me in my tracks. Because it's true, you can vet this out. If you pay attention and abide by the rules of the road, the rules of driving, this teaching becomes really basic, right? I mean, you put your seatbelt on, you stop at the stoplight, stop at the stop sign. We do this not only to protect ourselves, but to create harmony, to protect others, and it works. We can substitute that word protection to care. By caring for myself, I'm by extension caring for others. When I care for others, I am reaping the benefit of that. I am caring for myself. And we can expand that, of course, to what are our responses to this pandemic we've all been living in the last year. Do you stay home? Do you not stay home? Do you wear a mask? Do you not wear a mask? Do you get vaccinated? Do you not get vaccinated? And these are questions that each one of us needs to work with. How do you feel about that? How is that in line with your values? Is it for the greater good? Is it for your own good? Where do the two come together? So I want to take a look at these precepts that I know in this class, in our Wednesday morning class, for many, many years, once a month, we would meet a little bit earlier than class to recommit to refuges and precepts, refuges of the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, and recommitting to these precepts of non-harming. And that tradition stopped a couple of years ago. I'm not really sure, you know, I just sort of went by the wayside, or if it was a collective decision to stop doing that, I'm not sure. But I want to bring this in today. I want to talk for the next 15 minutes or so on these precepts and offer maybe a different way to relate to them. And then we'll go into a meditation in which we'll actually, we'll do a guided precept meditation that you can, for yourself, really let it sink into your heart as a meditation. So as you hear these precepts, you will, I imagine, recognize them as, you know, things, many things that you have heard many, many times before. And to take them in, knowing that they are a training, it's a process. It's not something that we're just going to finish today in this class and say, oh, I got that. It's just not how the Dharma works. It's not, you know, we're working on this continually. But to really take it in as truly a training, and also not a list of don't do. These are not commandments. This is just what we work with. So the first of these precepts is to not intentionally harm living beings. What does that mean? Right? Do you eat meat? Do you not eat meat? Do you kill bugs? Do you not kill bugs? Maybe certain kinds of bugs, but not this kind of bug. What is that? You know, this is something we each have to work with, about what does it mean to not kill living beings. But with each of these precepts, I like to flip them around from not what we don't do, but actually what we can do. So how do we undertake a training to honor and respect all life? Now that feels to me much, much more of an invitation than don't do. And that's because as humans in our psychology is that we do really well with positive feedback. So tell me what I can do to contribute. How do I honor and protect life? Remembering greed, ill will, and delusion pollute our hearts and minds. So noticing as they come up, knowing the truth that hatred never ends, by hatred, by non-hate alone does it end. That helps right there to honor and protect life. When we feel ill will rising in us, to just to know it but not act out of it. I love this poem from Diane Ackerman. You might know it, called School Prayer. In the name of the daybreak and the eyelids of morning and the wayfaring moon and the night when it departs, I swear I will not dishonor my soul with hatred, but offer myself humbly as a guardian of nature, as a healer of misery, as a messenger of wonder, as an architect of peace. In the name of the sun and its mirrors and the day that embrace it and the cloud veils drawn over it and the uttermost night and the male and the female and the plants bursting with seed and the crowning seasons of the firefly and the apple, I will honor all life, wherever and whatever form it may dwell, on earth, my home, and in the mansion of the stars. Do not dishonor my soul with hatred. The second of these precepts is to not take anything which isn't freely offered. Now that's in the traditional language of the Buddhist precepts. Of course, you know, don't take each other's stuff. But it's also, how are we in relationship? Do we take time? Do we take up most of the time in a conversation? What do we take for granted? What do we assume belongs to us? So let's flip that around. Can we undertake a training in which we share our time, our presence, our resources? And what does that mean for each one of us? We have to find our way with that. So if you are naturally, if generosity comes to you really naturally, is there a way that sometimes you give too much, where it's actually not to your benefit, where you create hardship for yourself? Or do you give too little? And I'm not talking about, you know, necessarily giving money away. I'm talking about your presence. I'm talking about your energy. How do you show up in the world? Is it too much? Is it too little? And back to Ed's point, there's a balance. How much effort? Where do we find our place in that? And every time in our meditation, we offer ourselves our own attention. That in and of itself is an act of generosity. Simone Weil says, attention is the rarest and purest form of generosity. Just to turn towards ourselves, to turn towards another, to be fully present in a conversation, to not have to have the last word, just to listen. So to explore, undertaking a training in which we share our time, our presence, our resources, whatever that is. The third one, this is where we get into wise speech, and we could do many weeks on wise speech. To undertake a training in which we're careful of how we speak, not speaking in a way that causes harm, gossip, lying, you know, exaggerating to a point that it takes things out of context or isn't even true, or speaking harshly. We all know how hard this can be. Especially when we're frightened, especially when we've received harsh words, do we have the discipline to not respond in the same way? So undertaking a training to speak kindly and carefully, not lying, can what we say come from a place of truth? and usefulness? Is it timely? Is it helpful? Here's what the Buddha said about that. Before admonishing anyone, one should reflect thus. In due season will I speak, not out of season. In truth will I speak, not in falsehood. In kindness will I speak, not in anger. Gently will I speak, not harshly. For this person's benefit will I speak, not for their loss. It's a big, tall order, isn't it? Right? It takes a lot of discipline and dedication and impulse control. You know that feeling of needing to get something off your chest? I know we know that. And we want the relief of that tension, because there is a tension that happens when we're holding on to something that we know wants to be said. Can we cultivate patience with that, discipline? If it's a person who we really want to get it out to, can we say, is this a good time? And if they say no, can we honor that? Can we say, well, what would be a good time for you? And do that. What a gift. That's an act of generosity. Or do we just dump, right? I just got to tell you my truth, because this is my truth. Having been the recipient of a lot of dumping, if anybody has raised children, you know about the dump, because, right? Is this what parents do? Maybe, you know, oh, mom, I just got to tell you, boom. And then what happens is, I can remember this as my kids were growing up, I called it the dump and run. And they would come and say, blah, 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 whatever it is. And say, oh man, I feel so much better. See ya, I gotta go. And there I am holding their pile of garbage that I'm not sure what I'm gonna do with. So how do we hold what we share with each other? This is also the practice. We're cultivating this clear mind, bhavana, through samadhi. And Jan Chosen Bays, who is a Zen priest in Oregon, she says, when the mind is clear, we can speak in a straightforward way with precision and without insulting others. When the mind is clear, we can speak in a straightforward way with precision, not insulting others. That is an intention of mine. I want to speak with precision. And I can only do that when my heart is really okay, present, relaxed, my mind is clear, and I'm not going to dump. I'm not going to dump. Or if I am, do I have a trusted partner in conversation where I can say, I just need to vent. I just want to dump. And then ask that person if it's okay. And if they say yes, great, we have permission. We can totally let go, because we're setting the groundwork for that. But you know, you got to be careful about that one. The fourth of these precepts, not using sexual energy inappropriately in any way that it can cause harm that exploits us or anybody else. So when I think of this precept, I expand it beyond sexual energy to caring for our bodies, caring for the bodies of others, respecting boundaries, knowing that we're safe, that physically we offer safety. So it could be, you know, let's just talk about non-COVID time. Some people love to give hugs, and some people are very uncomfortable with that. And so what happens if we can we ask permission? Might be somebody we haven't seen in a long time, and we really want to give them a hug. Can we say, it's so great to see you, may I give you a hug? And if the person says, no, actually, I'm not comfortable with that, can we take that in and not take it personally? Know that it's that person's boundary. This is how we become safe. This is how we really can show up fully in a kind, safe way. And the last of the precepts, not consuming anything to the degree that it clouds the mind, causes harm to the body, to the mind, to the heart, whether it's food, whether it's alcohol, whether it's other kind of drugs, whether it's media, whether it's too much exercise, whatever it is that we take in, can it be in balance to develop a clear mind and a healthy body? Restraint in consumption is a practice, right? It really is a practice. What do I need? What do I want? Where is that? Where is that place? So I think in summary, what these precepts do is they say, I undertake a training to take good care. And we keep coming back to redefining what does it mean to take good care of ourselves and others. And it's all woven in to our practices of our ethical conduct, to define and redefine what non-harming means, how we want to live. And then we become a zone of safety for ourselves and others when we really make this commitment to not intentionally cause harm. Eddie Hillison, who was a writer, I know I've shared her with you before, during the Holocaust, died in the Holocaust, she was Dutch. She says, ultimately, we have just one moral duty, to reclaim large areas of peace in ourselves, more and more peace, and reflect it out to others. And the more peace there is in us, the more peace there will also be in our world. So to know that every time you come to sit in meditation, to settle the mind and tend to the heart, creating more peace in yourself has a very real ripple effect. It really matters. And in this way, we are practicing for the benefit of others. To know that that is true. One of my favorite ways to think about the outcome of cultivating an ethical life, creating safety internally and externally, is from Annie Lamott, who says, lighthouses don't go around the island trying to rescue ships. They just stand there and shine. They just stand there and shine. Lighthouses don't go around the island trying to rescue ships. They just stand there and shine. And I think this is what the Buddha was talking about cultivating these practices and becoming an island unto oneself. Not meaning we're disconnected from each other. We're completely connected. But each one of us is doing our part. And then we become this bigger ocean of safety and love. The Buddha also said, whatever path of action you find that brings good and happiness to all, follow this way like the moon in the path of the stars. Whatever path of action you find that brings good and happiness to all, follow this way like the moon in the path of the stars. What I love about that is it honors each one of us, each one of our unique ways of living our lives. So whatever path works for you, do that, because we need each of us all in our complexity and diversity, and our own who we are, to bring our own flavor to this practice of kindness and morality and love and awareness. So after we take a short break, we'll come back and we'll do a meditation in which I will offer the precepts again as a meditation. But before we pause, are there any questions, any comments about anything that I said? Let's move into a meditation now in which I will offer the precepts and then we'll talk a little bit more on the other side. So once again, finding a posture in which you can be comfortable. Taking a couple of breaths to just arrive right here. And sensing into the body, noticing the touch points of the base of the body, the buttocks, the backs of the thighs, whatever furniture or the floor you're connected to. Sensing that connection, sensing that groundedness of the body. And how the spine grows out of the deep low back, all the way up through the back of the neck to the crown of the head. Can you sense that elongation? And even if you're reclining, there is a sense, there's even an uprightness that happens with the energy of the spine. See if you can sense into that. And holding just enough energy in the back body to stay awake and attentive. And inviting the whole front of the body, the face, the chest, the belly, to soften. Even softening the shoulders so there's room to breathe, room for the heart, making space. As Roshi Joan Halifax says, strong back, soft front. Strong back, soft front. Inviting the breath. So finding that place that feels most accessible for you, whether it's attending to the breath, attending to the body, settling there for a few minutes, coming back, of course, when the mind wanders and beginning again, just being here. Keeping the awareness, turning inward, dropping it down, even if it's into the breath of the body. If the mind is off somewhere, drawing it back, bringing it down in. If you feel sleepy, maybe too grounded, maybe there's some sluggishness, sensing that upward movement of the spine, bringing some energy up. And whatever the state of heart is, letting it belong, it's just as it is. And in this way, the body, mind, and heart are invited to arrive and be in the same place at the same time. And now drawing the awareness into the heart center, this area of the center of the chest and the upper back, just sensing the energy of the heart. There's nothing to do, nothing to change, just notice. Sometimes I like to put my hand right on my heart because it gives me a felt sense of the heart center connected to my hands. It's an option. I'm going to offer you these precepts now, just taking in their intention. And again, letting it wash through you, let it wash over you, just sensing in. And if you would like to repeat them silently to yourself as a way to reaffirm your own commitment to your ethical life, do that. If not, just listen. It's fine. I undertake the training to honor and respect all life. I undertake the training to honor and respect all life. I undertake the training to share my time and resources in a balanced way. I undertake the training to share my time and presence and resources in a balanced way. I undertake the training to speak kindly and carefully for the benefit of myself and others. I undertake the training to speak kindly and carefully for the benefit of myself and others. I undertake the training to be careful with my body, with sexual energy, respecting boundaries, and offering safety to myself and others. I undertake the training to be careful with my body, respecting boundaries, and offering safety for myself and others. I undertake the training to develop a clear mind and a healthy body by practicing restraint and balance in consumption. I undertake the training to develop a clear mind and healthy body by practicing restraint in consumption. And for the benefit of myself and others, I undertake the training to take good care. For the benefit of myself and others, I undertake this training to take good care. coming back. You know, that's a practice that I do. This is a regular part of my own meditation, and it brings me peace to recite those precepts. I feel like it course corrects, keeps me on the rails. You know, just it's a sweet practice, and it's even sweeter to do it with you as a group, all doing this together. I think it has a collective power. So thank you for doing this. Yeah. So one of the questions that consistently comes up for me is in the Dharma is that sometimes these teachings, they sound great. They can be really lofty, really beautiful. And sometimes I think to myself, okay, but how do I literally do this? I can take the precepts, I can realign with the values of non-harming, with my good intentions, but sometimes we need something a little bit more tangible. Like, how do we really do that? So one of the practices that I think that the Buddha also gave us that gives us a doorway into this is the practice of wise effort. And this is right at the heart of the Eightfold Path, these eight different ways of cultivating the clear mind, the steady heart, presence of mind, mindful awareness. And this is, I think that wise effort can be an unsung hero of the Eightfold Path. It's right in the middle of it. And what it is knowing how to manage, actually to Jane's question, I think, how do we manage wholesome and unwholesome states of mind? It's the knowing of the presence or absence of wholesome or unwholesome states of mind. So I find that this is actually kind of an interesting way to relate to the precepts in all of their beauty, in all of their strength, and also to notice the relationship between different teachings and how they actually support one another. So wise effort is also called the four great endeavors. And I think of it also as a great navigation of the mind. And it has four primary ways to navigate and to know the mind, the great endeavors. And I'll just give you the quick list and then we'll go through each of them and then we'll talk with each other a little bit more. So there's a practice of prevention, a practice of release, a practice of cultivation, and a practice of enhancement. So let's go through all of those. So the first one, the first aspect of wise effort is to prevent unwholesome, difficult states of mind from arising. Now, we all know that we get difficult states of mind. So some of this you might think, oh yeah, right. And I would agree, you know, that this is not so easy. But we get to know the ignoble thoughts. We get to know, oh, there it is. And because from the perspective of Buddhist practice, this is all in the service of liberation, all in the service of freeing our minds and hearts from that which keeps us stuck, going in these repetitive cycles of suffering. That's why this language is like this. To prevent the arising, this is how it actually works in the teaching, which is such a mouthful. So you can change it however you want, and I'll share how I've changed it. To prevent the arising of unarisen, unwholesome thoughts. Now that's a tongue twister. To prevent the arising of unarisen, unwholesome thoughts. So what do we need to do to note the conditions of mind, or what are the things that we are exposed to, states of mind, that lead to arising of unwholesome mind states? And an unwholesome mind state, we can just call it a difficult mind state. So we're not judging the mind state. So when anger, pain, resentment, blame, those are difficult states of mind that are part of being human. And so let's not get into, you know, being the inner critic and judging ourselves. Oh my God, I had this ignoble thought. Well, of course. I mean, this is just what happens. But we want to note what are the conditions that bring us into that place, that open the mind to that place. You know, watching too much news for me brings me into a place where these difficult states of mind can more easily arise. What are the conditions that lead to greed, ill will, ignorance, anger, resentment, blame, hate, envy, and jealousy? Those are really tough states of mind to be in. So what can I do to prevent them from arising? So that's the first great endeavor, is to know them and to protect ourselves from them arising in the first place. The second one, what the Buddha says, is abandoning these states of mind when they are present. How do we release them? How do we disentangle from them the unwholesome states of mind? So when the judgmental mind arises, can we say, oh, judgmental mind, oh, ignoble thought, instead of saying, you know, like using some term that makes a difficult thought process worse, like, you know, think, how could you be thinking that? Well, we are thinking that. You know, we don't need to be unkind to ourselves about it. Just to note it and gently, oh, right, judgmental thought. Learn to recognize when the Velcro hooks of these ignoble thoughts get in us. How do we learn to release them? And this is where we need practices of metta, of compassion, of empathy, of forgiveness of self. We need these heart practices so we can manage whole unwholesome mind states. They are nurturing and they are remedies. And to Karma's point, we also need to notice what's good. It really helps, because the difficult or unwholesome mind state is only one part of what is going on. And oftentimes it can be the biggest thing that we notice, you know, the loudest voice. It's on the front burner. It's the thing that takes all of our attention, because we have a negativity bias in the brain. We are wired to notice what is difficult, and we tend to go to that place. So the first two of these great endeavors, this great navigation of wise effort, are pointing to the difficult states of mind, to prevent them from arising by being careful with our exposures. But when they are there, learning how to let them go and learning how to recognize them, to do some inquiry, oh yeah, this is what's happening, and to nurture ourselves, to bringing these beautiful heart practices in. Sylvia says, I'm a happier person when I do not have disparaging thoughts. I am a happier person when I do not have disparaging thoughts. So notice that. Just notice that in yourself. When you have disparaging thoughts, what are the consequences internally for you? What happens in the body chemistry? What happens in the interactions? Typically, it's uncomfortable. And what it does, I think, is it cuts us off. It cuts us off from others. We have less access to our good hearts. And that's painful, right? This is where the othering comes from. It prevents the connection. It can prevent the sense of deep belonging. So the third, now we move into the part of wise effort, which really looks at how do we set ourselves up for a mind that is filled more with wholesome thoughts. So we cultivate and nurture and create the conditions in which these more positive mind states can arise. So when there's a peaceful mind, we know it. When the mind is at ease, we know it. when we're not in contention with whatever is happening. And our meditation practice is really helpful for this, because the meditation practice is training the mind towards this clarity, towards balance, towards this stillness. And when that is there, we can see more clearly. And so this is why we want to have practices that nurture these wholesome mind states. And again, heart practices do that. And even practices of the body, whether it's Qigong or Tai Chi or riding your bike, going for a walk, ways that nurture in a wholesome way our body practices, by extension, certainly influence the heart and mind. So when we cultivate and nurture states like generosity, kindness, compassion, patience, respect, whatever it is, that is creating the conditions for the wholesome states of mind to arise. And then, and I think this is the part that's so powerful, is when you know that the mind is in a space that is wholesome, positive, at ease, we want to not only maintain it, but we want to enhance that. How do we enhance positive mind states? Because what that does when we do is it shifts the neural pathway from the things that are really difficult, the habitual ways of thinking about what's wrong and the things that keep us caught, to making more of a habit to seeing what is right and knowing how that actually feels in the body. What is the reverberation, the ripple effects inside of us? And that's a positive feedback loop. The more we do that and we can sense how that feels, the more likely we'll do it. Because we respond to, this is the positive psychology. If there's a carrot at the end of the tunnel, we're likely to go for it. There's something positive there for us. And we're wired that way too. So when generous thoughts, as an example, when a generous thought arises, act on it, develop it further. So you have the inclination to do something that is of benefit to somebody else, and remembering we are the primary recipients of our generosity, even though it appears it's going somewhere else, and it is, but we benefit from that. You get the thought to do something generous, and you do it, and then you remember that you've done it. It feels really good, right? It shows you what you can do. This is the positive feedback loop. When we look for the good, that also really helps to maintain and enhance wholesome states, because it seasons us, right? It flavors the mind. So whether or not you are in your meditation or daily life, working with wise effort, wholesome and unwholesome states of mind takes discipline, takes practice and patience and steadiness, persistent mindfulness. And also with this generosity of spirit, this willingness to really get to know our own minds. What are the conditions that support my well-being? What are the conditions that don't? And then we come back to what the Buddha said, I teach one thing, suffering and the end of suffering. And it's underneath that big overall teaching that all these practices exist. So the bottom line, I think, is when our efforts are wise and ethical and clear, we're likely not to cause harm to ourselves or anybody else. And we're much more likely to make good, considered decisions. And I also want to say it's not so easy, right? We all know this is not so easy. This is a lifetime practice. Rabbi Tarfon, who was a third century rabbi, says, it's not upon you to finish the work, nor are you free to desist from it. It's not upon you to finish the work, nor are you free to desist from it. It's a beautiful teaching. We just keep going. We just keep going. And we need each other. We need each other to support our ethical lives. We need each other to support the health and wellness, our wholeness of mind and heart. We can't do it alone, so we don't have to take it all on, but we have to keep going.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.